existence had become a tunnel, whose walls were death, and within which prevailed no hope of rescue or deliverance. The sky had ceased to be, and the sun and stars. All that remained was the earth, the churned, riven dirt, which seemed to wait at each man's feet to receive his spilling guts, his shattered bones, his blood, his life. The earth coated every part of him. It was in his ears and nostrils, in his eyes and throat, under his nails, and in the crease of his backside. It coated the sweat and salt of his hair. He spat it from his lungs and blew it slick with snot from his nose. There is a secret all warriors share, so private that none dare give it voice, save only to those mates drawn dearer than brothers by the shared ordeal of arms. This is the knowledge of the 100 acts of his own cowardice, the little things that no one sees, the comrade who fell and cried for aid, did I pass him by, choose my skin over his? That was my crime, of which I accuse myself in the tribunal of my heart, and there condemn myself as guilty. All a man wants is to live. This before all, to cling to breath, to survive. Yet even this most primal of instincts, self-preservation, even this necessity of the blood shared by all beneath heaven, beasts as well as man, even this may be worn down by fatigue and excess of horror. A form of courage enters the heart which is not courage but despair, and not despair but exaltation. On that second day men passed beyond themselves. Feats of heart-stopping valor fell from the sky like rain, and those who performed them could not even recall nor state with certainty that the actors had been themselves. I saw a squire of the Flyans, no more than a boy, take up his master's armor and wade into the manslaughter. Before he could strike a blow, a Persian javelin shattered his shin, driving straight through the bone. One of his mates rushed to the lad to bind his gushing artery and drag him to safety. The youth beat back his savior with the flat of his sword. He hobbled upon his spear, used as a crutch, then on his knees into the fray, still hacking at the foe from the earth where he perished. Other squires and servants seized iron pegs and, themselves unshod and unarmored, scaled the mountain face above the narrows, hammering the pins into cracks of rock to secure themselves from these exposed perches, hurling stones and boulders down upon the foe. The Persian archers turned these boys into pincushions. Their bodies dangled crucified from pitons, or tumbled from their finger-holds to crash upon the roiling slaughter below. The merchant, Elephantinos, dashed into the open to save one of these lads yet living, hung up on a ledge above the rear of battle. A Persian arrow tore the old man's throat out. He fell so fast he seemed to vanish straight into the earth. Fierce fighting broke out over his corpse. Why? He was no king or officer, only a stranger who tended the young men's wounds and made them laugh with, "Wake up to this." Night had nearly fallen. The Hellenes were reeling from casualties and exhaustion, while the Persians continued pouring fresh champions into the fray. Those in the foe's rear were being driven onward by the whips of their own officers. These pressed with zeal upon their fellows, driving them forward into the Greeks. Does His Majesty remember? A violent squall had broken then over the sea. Rain began sheeting in torrents. By this point, most of the allies' weapons had been spent or broken. The warriors had gone through a dozen spears apiece. None yet bore his own shield, which had been staved in long since. He defended himself with the 8th and 10th he had snatched from the ground. Even the Spartans' short Xiphos swords had been sundered from excess of blows. The steel blades held, but the hafts and grips had come undone. Men were fighting with stubs of iron, thrusting with shivered half-spears bereft of warhead and butt-spike. The host of the foe had hacked their way forward within a dozen paces of the wall. Only the Spartans and Thespians remained before this battlement, all others of the allies having been beaten back behind or upon it. The massed myriads of the enemy extended all the way from the narrows, flooding at will across the 100-yard triangle before the wall. The Spartans fell back. I found myself beside Alexandros atop the wall, hauling one man after another up and over, while the allies rained javelins and shivered spears, stones and boulders and even helmets and shields down upon the onpressing foe. The allies cracked and reeled. Back they fell in a disordered mass, 50 feet, 100, beyond the wall. Even the Spartans withdrew in disorder, my master Polynices, Alpheus, and Merin themselves shattered by wounds and exhaustion. The enemy literally tore the stones from the face of the wall. Now the tide of their multitude flooded over the toppled ruins, skidding down the stadium steps of the wall's rear onto the open earth before the unprotected camps of the allies. Vanquishment was moments away when, for cause inexplicable, the foe, with victory before him in his palm, pulled up in fear and could not find courage to press home the kill. The enemy drew up, seized by a terror without source or signature. What force had unmanned their hearts and robbed them of valor, no faculty of reason may divine. It may have been that the warriors of the empire could not credit the imminence of their own triumph. Perhaps they had been fighting for so long on the foreside of the wall that their senses could not embrace the reality of at last achieving the breach. Whatever it was, the foe's momentum faltered. A moment of unearthly stillness seized the field. Suddenly, from the heavens, a bellow of unearthly power, as that from the throats of 50,000 men, pealed through the ether. The hair stood straight up on my neck. I spun toward Alexandros. He, too, held rooted, paralyzed in awe and terror, as every other man upon the field. A bolt of almighty magnitude slammed overhead into the wall of Calydromus. Thunder boomed. Great stones blew from the cliff face. Smoke and sulfur rent the air. On rolled that unearthly cry, nailing all in place with terror, save Leonidas, who now strode to the fore with upraised spear. "Zeus, savior!" the king's voice rose into the thunder. "Hellas and freedom!" He cried the paean and rushed forward upon the foe. Fresh courage flooded the allies' hearts. They roared into the counterattack. Back over the wall, the enemy tumbled in panic at this prodigy of heaven. I found myself again atop its slick and sundered stones, firing shaft after shaft into the mass of Persians and Bactrians, Medes and Illyrians, Lydians and Egyptians, stampeding in flight below. The ghastliness of the carnage that followed, His Majesty's own eyes may testify to. As the foreranks of the Persians fled in terror, the whips of their rear men drove their reinforcing fellows forward. As when two waves, one crashing shoreward before the storm, the other returning seaward down the steep slope of the strand, collide and annihilate one another in spray and foam, so did the crash and wheel of the empire's armies turn force upon force to trample by thousands those trapped within the riptide of its vortex. Leonidas had earlier called upon the allies to build a second wall, a wall of Persian bodies. Precisely this now eventuated. The foe fell in such numbers that no warrior of the allies planted soul upon the earth. One trod upon bodies. On bodies, atop bodies. Ahead, the Hellenic warriors could see the enemy stampeding into the whips of their own rear men, charging them, slaying with spear and sword their own fellows in blood madness to escape. Scores and hundreds toppled into the sea. I saw the Spartan front ranks literally scaling the wall of Persian bodies, needing assistance from the second rankers just to propel themselves over. Suddenly the piled mass of the dead gave way, an avalanche of bodies began. In the narrows, the allies scrambled rearward toward safety atop a landslide of corpses, which fed upon itself, gaining momentum from its own weight as it tumbled with unrolling might upon the Persians, back down the track toward Trachis. So grotesque was this sight that the Hellenic warriors, unordered by command, but of their own instinct, pulled up where they stood and discontinued the press of their advance. looking on in awe as the enemy perished in numbers uncountable, swallowed and effaced beneath this grisly avalanche of flesh. Now, in the night assembly of the Allies, this prodigy was recalled and cited as evidence of the intercession of the gods. The nobleman Tiristiades stood beside Leonidas, before the assembled Greeks, urging them, with what was clearly the passionate beneficence of his heart, to retreat, withdraw, get out. The noble repeated his report of the 10,000 immortals, even now advancing upon the mountain track to encircle the allies. Less than 1,000 Hellenes remained still capable of resistance. What could these hope to effect against 10 times their number striking from the undefended rear, while 1,000 times their total compounded the assault from the fore? Yet such was the exultation produced by that final prodigy that the allies would neither listen nor pay heed. Men came forward in assembly, skeptics and agnostics, those who acknowledged their doubt and even disdain of the gods. These same men now swore mighty oaths and declared that this bolt of heaven and the unearthly bellow which had accompanied it had been none other than the war cry of Zeus himself. More heartening news had come in from the fleet. A storm, unseasonably spawned this prior night, had wrecked 200 of the enemy's warships on the far shore of Euboea. 1/5 of His Majesty's navy, the Athenian corvette captain Hebronikes reported with exultation, had been lost with all hands. He had beheld the wreckage this day with his own eyes. Might not this, too, be the work of God? Leontiades, the Theban commander, stepped forward, seconding and inflaming the derangement. What force of man, he demanded, may stand up before the rage of heaven? Bear this in mind, brothers and allies, that 9/10 of the Persians' army are conscripted nations, drafted against their will at the point of a sword. How will Xerxes continue to hold them in line? Like cattle, as today, driven onward with whips? Believe me, men, the Persians' allies are cracking. Discontent and disaffection are spreading like pestilence through their camp. Desertion and mutiny lie one more defeat away. If we can hold tomorrow, brothers, Xerxes' predicament will compel him to force the issue at sea. Poseidon, who shakes the earth, has already wreaked havoc once upon the Persians' pride. Perhaps the god may cut him down to size again. The Greeks, inflamed by the Theban commander's passion, hurled harsh words at the Chemian Tiristiades. The allies swore it was not they who stood now in peril, but Xerxes himself and his overweening pride, which had called forth the wrath of the Almighty. I did not need to glance to my master to read his heart. This derangement of the allies was catalepsis, possession. It was madness, as surely the speakers themselves knew, even as they spewed their grief and horror-spawned rage at the convenient target of the Chemian noble. The prince himself bore this abuse in silence, sorrow darkening his already grave features. Leonidas dismissed the assembly, instructing each contingent to turn its attention to the repair and refitting of weapons. He dispatched the Athenian captain, Hebronikes, back to the fleet, with orders to inform the naval commanders, Eurybiades and Themistocles, of all he had heard and seen here tonight. The allies dispersed, leaving only the Spartans and the nobleman Tiristiades beside the commander's fire. "A most impressive testimony of faith, my lord," the prince spoke after some moments. "Such devout orations cannot fail to sustain your men's courage. For an hour. Until darkness and fatigue efface the passion of the moment, and fear for themselves and their families resurfaces, as it must, within their hearts." The noble repeated with emphasis his report of the mountain track and the 10,000. He declared that if the hand of the gods was at all present in this day's events, it was not their benevolence seeking to preserve the Hellenic defenders, but their perverse and unknowable will acting to detach them from their reason. Surely a commander of Leonidas's sagacity perceived this, as clearly as he, lifting his glance to the cliff of Calidromus, could behold there upon the rock the scores of lightning scars where over decades and centuries numerous other random bolts had in the natural course of coastal storms struck here upon this, the loftiest and most proximate promontory. Tiresiades again pressed Leonidas and the officers to credit his report. The Deimos in assembly may elect to disbelieve him. They may denounce and even execute him as a spy. Their reason may deceive itself and embrace a propitious prospect for the morrow. Their king and commander, however, cannot permit himself such luxury. Say, the Persian pressed, that I am an agent of intrigue. Believe I have been sent by Xerxes. Say that my intention is in his interest, to influence you by guile and artifice to quit the pass. Say and believe all this. Yet still, my report is true. The immortals are coming. They will appear by morning 10,000 strong in the allied rear. With a step, the noble moved before the Spartan king, addressing him with passion, man to man. This struggle at the hot gates will not be the decisive one, my lord. That battle will come later, deeper into Greece, perhaps before the walls of Athens, perhaps at the Isthmus, perhaps within the Peloponnese, beneath the peaks of Sparta herself. You know this. Any commander who can read terrain and topography knows it. Your nation needs you, sir. You are the soul of her army. You may say that a king of Lacedaemon never retreats, but valor must be tempered with wisdom, or it is merely recklessness. Consider what you and your men have accomplished at the hot gates already. The fame you have won in these 6 days will live forever. Do not seek death for death's sake, nor to fulfill a vain prophecy. Live, sir, and fight another day. Another day with your whole army at your back, another day when victory, decisive victory, may be yours. The Persian gestured to the Spartan officers clustered in the light of the council fire. The polemarch Dercyllides, the knights Polyneikes and Dorion, the platoon commanders and the warriors Alpheus and Merin and my master. I beg you, sir, conserve these, the flower of Lacedaemon, to give their lives another day. Spare yourself for that hour. You have proved your valor, my lord. Now I beseech you, demonstrate your wisdom. Withdraw now. Get yourself and your men out while you still can. Book 7. Leonidas. Chapter 30. There would be 11 in the party to raid His Majesty's tent. Leonidas refused to hazard a greater number. He begrudged even this many of the 108 who remained of the 300 yet in condition to fight, countenancing the inclusion of 5 peers only, and that purely to give the party credibility among the allies. Deianikes would lead as the ablest small unit commander. The knights Polyneikes and Dorion were included for their speed and prowess, and Alexandros, over Leonidas's objections seeking to spare him to fight beside my master as a dias. The Skiritai hound and Lacedes would go. They were mountaineers. They knew how to scale sheer faces. The outlaw ball player would serve as guide up the cliff face of Calidromus, and Rooster would take the company into the enemy camp. Suicide and I were included to support Deianikes and Alexandros, and to augment with javelin and bow the party's striking power. The final Spartiate was Telamonius, a boxer of the Wild Olive Regiment. After Polyneikes and Dorion, he was the fastest of the 300, and the only one of the raiders unhampered by wounds. The Thespian Dithyrambos had been the force behind the adoption of the plan, conceiving of it on his own, without prompting from Rooster, whom my master had not executed after all, but instead ordered detained in camp throughout the second day with instructions to look to the wounded and the repair and replacement of weapons. Dithyrambos had lobbied strenuously with Leonidas in favor of the raid, and now, disappointed as he was not to be included himself, he stood to hand to wish the party well. Night's chill had descended upon the camp. As the nobleman Tiristiades had predicted, fear now stood hard upon the allies. They were one rumor away from terror, and one perceived prodigy from panic. Dithyrambos understood the militiamen's hearts. These needed some prospect to fix their hopes upon this night, some expectation to hold them steadfast till morning. Let the raid succeed or fail, it did not matter, just send men out. And if indeed the gods have taken our part in this cause, well, Dithyrambos grinned and clasped my master's hand in farewell. Deianikes divided the party into two units, one of five under Polyneikes, the other of six under his own command. Each squad was to scale the cliff face independently, advancing across Calydramus on its own to the rendezvous point beneath the cliffs of Trachis. This to increase the likelihood, in the event of ambush or capture, of at least one party getting through to strike. When the men were armed and ready to move out, both parties presented themselves for final orders from Leonidas. The king spoke to them alone, without the allies or even the Spartan officers present. A cold wind had gotten up. The sky rumbled above Euboea. The mountain face loomed overhead. The moon, as yet only partially shrouded, could be glimpsed above the shreds of wind-torn fog. Leonidas offered the party's wine from his personal store and poured the libations from his own plain cup. He addressed each man, squires included, not by his name but by his nickname, and even the diminutive of that. He called Dorion Little Hare, the knight's play name from childhood. Dectan he addressed not as Rooster but Roo, and touched him with tenderness upon the shoulder. "I've had your papers of manumission drawn," the king informed the helot. "They'll be in the courier's pouch for Lacedaemon tonight. They emancipate you as well as your family, and they free your infant son." This was the babe whose life the lady Arete had saved. That night, before the Crypteia, the child whose being had made Deianikes under Lacedaemonian law the father of a living son, and thus eligible for inclusion among the 300. It was this infant whose life would mean Deianikes's death, and Alexandros's, and suicides by their association with him. And mine as well. "If you wish," Leonidas's eyes met Rooster's in the gust-driven firelight, "you may change the name, Eidetikides, by which the babe is now called. It is a Spartan name, and we all know you bear scant affection for our race." This name, Eidetikides, one may recall, was that of Rooster's father, Arete's brother, who had fallen in battle years before. The name the lady had insisted upon giving the babe that night of the rump court behind the mess. "You're free to call your son by his Messenian name," Leonidas continued to Rooster, "but you must tell me now before I seal the papers and dispatch them." I had seen Rooster whipped and beaten any number of times upon our chores and details in Lacedaemon, but never till this moment had I seen his eyes well and fill. "I am struck with shame, sir," he addressed Leonidas, "to have extracted this kindness by extortion." Rooster straightened before the king. He declared the name Eidetikides a noble one, which his son would be proud to bear. The king nodded and placed his hand, warm as a father's, upon Dectan's shoulder. "Come back alive this night, Roo. I'll get you out to safety in the morning." Before Deianikes' party had climbed half a mile above Alpinoi, heavy pellets of rain began to strike. The gentle slope had turned to cliff wall, whose composition was maritime conglomerate, chalky and rotten. When the downpour hit, the surface turned to soup. Ballplayer took the lead past the initial ascent, but it soon became apparent that he had lost his way in the dark. We were off the main track and into the bewildering network of goat trails that crisscrossed the steepening face. The party made up the trace as it went along, groping in the dark with one man taking his turn in the lead, unburdened, while the others followed, bearing the shields and weapons. None wore helmets, just undercaps of felt. These became drenched and sodden, spilling cascades from their brimless fronts into the men's eyes. The climb became out-and-out mountaineering, traversing from toehold to handhold, with each man's cheek mashed flat against the rotten face, while icy torrents sluiced upon him, accompanied by landslides of mud as the boulders and stones of the face released their hold, and all this in the dark. For myself, my shot calf had cramped up and now burned as if a poker had been buried molten within the flesh. Each upward heave compelled exertion of this muscle. The pain nearly knocked me faint. Dianeces was laboring even more miserably. His old wound from Achilleon prevented him from raising his left arm above his shoulder. His right ankle was incapable of flexion. To top it off, the socket of his gouged eye had begun to bleed afresh, rainwater mingled with the dark blood runneling through his beard and down onto the leathers of his corselet. He squinted across to Suicide, whose pair of shot shoulders made him slither like a snake, arms held low to his side as he writhed up the crumbling, mud-slick, rotting slope. "By the gods," Dianeces muttered, "this outfit is a mess." The party reached the first crest after an hour. We were above the fog now. The rain ceased. At once the night became clear, windy and cold. The sea rumbled 1,000 feet below, blanketed an eighth of a mile deep in a marine fog whose cottony peaks shone brilliant white beneath a moon only one night shy of full. Suddenly ballplayers signed for silence. The party dropped for cover. The outlaw pointed out across a chasm. Upon the opposite ridge, a third of a mile away, could be descried the tented throne of His Majesty, the one from upon which he had observed the first 2 days of battle. Servants were dismantling the platform and pavilion. "They're packing up. For where? Maybe they've had enough. They're heading home." The party skittered down off the skyline to a shadowed ledge, where it could not be seen. Everything the men bore was soaked. I wrung a compress and wound it fresh for my master's eye. "My brains must be leaking along with the blood," he said. "I can't think of another explanation for why I'm out here on this ass-fucked errand." He had the men take more wine, for the warmth and to deaden the pain of their various wounds. Suicide continued squinting across to the far ridge and the Persian servants striking their master's theater seats.
"Xerxes thinks tomorrow will be the end. Bet on it. We'll see him on horseback at dawn in the narrows to savor his triumph at close hand."
The ridge saddle was broad and level. With ballplayer in the lead, the party made good time for the next hour, following game trails that wove among the scrub, sumac, and fireweed. The track ran inland now, the sea no longer in sight. We crossed two more ridges, then struck a wild watercourse, one of the torrents that fed the Asopus. At least, that's what our outlaw guide guessed. Dianeces touched my shoulder, indicating a peak to the north.
"That's Oeta, where Heracles died.
Do you think he'll help us tonight?" The party reached a wooded upslope that had to be climbed hand over hand. Suddenly, a swift crashing burst from the thicket above. Forms shot forth, invisible. Every hand flew to a weapon. "Men?" The sound receded swiftly above.
"Deer."
In a heartbeat, the beasts were 100 feet gone. Silence. Just the wind tearing the treetops above us. For some reason, this serendipitous find heartened the party tremendously. Alexandros pushed forward into the thicket. The earth where the deer had taken shelter was dry, crushed and matted where the herd had lain, flank to flank.
"Feel the grass. It's still warm."
Ballplayer assumed a stance to urinate.
"Don't," Alexandros nudged him, or the deer will never use this nest again.
What's that to you? Piss down the slope, Dianeces commanded. Odd as it sounds, the feeling within that cozy copse evoked a hearth of home, a haven. One could still smell that deery smell, the gamey scent of their coats. None of the party spoke, yet each, I will wager, was thinking the same thought. How sweet it would be, right now, to lie down here like the deer, and close one's eyes. To allow all fear to depart one's limbs. To be, just for a moment, innocent of terror.
It's good hunting country, I observed. Those were boar runs we passed through. I'll bet there are bear up here, and even lion.
Dianeces' glance met Alexandros's with a glint. We'll have ourselves a hunt here, next fall. What do you say? The youth's broken face contorted into a grin. You'll join us, Rooster, Dianeces proposed. We'll take a week and make an event of it. No horses or beaters, just 2 dogs per man. We'll live off the hunt and come home draped in lion skins like Heracles. We'll even invite our dear friend Polynices.
Rooster regarded Dianeces as if he had gone mad. Then a wry grin settled into place upon his features.
Then it's settled, my master said. Next fall.
From the succeeding crest, the party followed the watercourse down. The torrent was loud, and discipline got careless. From out of nowhere arose voices. Every man froze. Rooster crouched in the lead. The party was strung out in column, the worst possible lineup to fight from.
Are they speaking Persian?
Alexandros whispered, straining his ears toward the sound. Suddenly the voices froze, too. They had heard us. I could see Suicide, 2 steps below me, silently stretched behind his shoulder, slipping a pair of darning needles from his quiver. Dianeces, Alexandros, and Rooster all clutched 8-footers. Ballplayer readied a throwing axe.
"Hey, fuckers, is that you?"
Out of the darkness stepped Hound, the Skirite, with a sword in one hand and a dagger in the other.
"By the gods, you scared the shit out of us."
It was Polynices' party, pausing to gnaw a heel of dry bread.
"What is this, a picnic?"
Dianeces slid down among them. We all clapped our mates in relief. Polynices reported that the outroute his party had taken, the lower track, had been fast and easy. They had been in this clearing a quarter of an hour.
"Come down here," the knight motioned to my master. "Take a look at this."
The whole party followed. On the opposite bank of the watercourse, 10 feet up the slope, stretched a track wide enough for 2 men to pass abreast. Even in the deep shadow of the gorge, you could see the churned-up earth.
"It's the mountain track, the one the immortals are taking. What else can it be?"
Dianeces knelt to feel the earth. It was freshly trodden, the passage no more than 2 hours old. You could glimpse on the uphill side the ridges where the marching souls of the 10,000 had caved the hill in, and the slides on the downslope from the weight of their passage. Dianeces chose one of Polynices's men, Telamonius the boxer, to retrace the track their party had taken and inform Leonidas. The man groaned with disappointment.
"None of that," Dianeces snapped. "You're the fastest who knows the trail. It has to be you."
The boxer sprinted off. Another of Polynices's party was absent.
"Where's Dorian?"
"Down the track, taking a snoop." A moment later, the knight, whose sister Althea was Polynices's wife, came loping into view from below. He was Gymnos, naked for speed.
"What happened to your dog?"
Polynices greeted him merrily.
"The little fellow has shriveled into an acorn."
The knight grinned and snatched his cloak from where it hung upon a tree. He reported that the track ended about a quarter mile down. There an entire forest had been felled, probably this very evening, immediately after the Persians had learned of the track. The immortals had no doubt marshaled there on the freshly cleared ground before setting out.
"What's there now?"
"Cavalry,"
3, maybe 4 squadrons. These were Thessalians, the knight reported, Greeks whose country had gone over to the enemy. They're snoring like farmers. The fog is soup. Every nose is buried in a cloak. Sentries, too.
Can we go around?
Dorian nodded. It's all pine, a carpet of soft needles. You can cross on a dead run and not make a sound.
Dianeces indicated the clearing in which the parties now stood. This will be our rally point. We'll assemble hereafter. You'll guide us back from this point, Dorian, or one of your party, by the way you came, the fast way.
Dianeces had Rooster rebrief both parties on the layout of the enemy camp, in case something happened to him on the way down. The last of the wine was shared out. The skin, in its sequence, chanced to pass from Polyneikes' hand to Rooster's. The helot seized this moment of intimacy before action.
"Tell me the truth. Would you have killed my son that night with the Cryptea?"
"I'll kill him yet," the runner answered, "if you fuck us up tonight."
"In that case," the helot said, "I look forward with even greater anticipation to your death."
It was time for Ballplayer to depart. He had agreed to guide the party this far and no farther. To the surprise of all, the outlaw seemed torn. "Look," he offered haltingly, "I want to keep on with you. You're good men. I admire you, but I can't, in good conscience, without being compensated." This struck the entire party as hilarious.
"Your scruples are stern, outlaw," Dianeces observed.
"You want compensation?" Polyneikes clutched his own privates. "I'll save this for you."
Ballplayer alone did not laugh.
"God damn you," he muttered, more to himself than to the others.
With further grumbled curses, he took his place in the undermanned column. He was staying. The party would no longer be divided. From here it would advance in teams of 5, Ballplayer attached to Polyneikes's 4 to make up for Telamonius, but in tandem, each unit supporting the other. The squads ghosted without incident past the snoozing Thessalians. The presence of this Greek cavalry was extremely good fortune. The way back, if there was one, would inevitably be in disorder. It would be of no small advantage to have a landmark as conspicuous in the dark as an acres-wide swath of felled forest. The Thessalians' horses could be stampeded to create confusion, and if the party had to flee under fire through their camp, its shouts to one another in Greek would not betray it among the Greek-speaking Thessalians. Another half-hour brought the squads to the edge of a wood directly above the citadel of Trachis. The channel of the Esopus thundered beneath the city walls. It roared in torrent, deafening, with a sharp cold wind keening down the throat of the gorge. We could see the enemy camp now. Surely no sight beneath heaven, not Troy under siege, nor the war of the gods and Titans itself could have equaled in scale that which now spread before our vision. As far as the eye could see, 3 miles of plain extending to the sea, 5 miles across, with plain and more plain extending beyond sight around the shoulders of the Trachinian cliffs, thousands of acres square, and all of it incandescent with the mist-magnified fires of the enemy.
"So much for them packing up."
Dianeces motioned Rooster to him. The helot laid it out as he remembered. "Xerxes' horses drink upstream of all, before the rest of the camp. Rivers are sacred to the Persians and must be preserved unprofaned. The whole upper valley is staked out as pasturage. The great king's pavilion, so Rooster swore, stood at the head of the plain, within bowshot of the river." The party dropped down, directly beneath the citadel walls, and entered the current. The Eurotas in Lacedaemon is mountain-fed. Even in summer, its snow-melt is bone-numbingly cold. The Esopus was worse. One's limbs went to ice within moments. It was so cold, we feared for our safety. If you had to get out and run, you couldn't feel your own legs and feet. Mercifully, the torrent lessened a few hundred yards down. The party rolled its cloaks into bundles and floated them on shields turned bowls up.
Dams had been erected by the enemy to abate the torrent and facilitate the watering of horses and men. Pickets had been stationed atop these, but the fog and wind made conditions so inhospitable, the hour was so late and the sentries so complacent, deeming infiltration unthinkable, that the party was able to steal past, bellying over the spillways, then coasting swiftly into the shadows along the bank. The moon had set. Rooster could not pick out His Majesty's pavilion.
"It was here, I swear it."
He pointed across to a rise of land, upon which stood nothing but a street of grooms' tents snapping in the wind, and a rope picket line shoulder to shoulder with horses standing miserably in the gale.
"They must have moved it."
Dionyces himself drew his blade. He was going to open Rooster's throat on the spot as a traitor. Rooster swore by every god he could think of. He wasn't lying.
"Things looked different in the dark," he offered lamely.
Polynices saved him. "I believe him, Dionyces. He's so fucking stupid this is just the way he would screw it up." The party slithered on, neck deep in marrow-numbing rapids. At one point Dionyces' leg became snarled in a tangle of reeds. He had to submerge with his xiphos to cut himself free. He came up snorting. I asked what he was laughing at. "I was just wondering if it was possible to get any more miserable." He chuckled darkly. "I suppose if a river snake crawled up my ass and gave birth to quintuplets." Suddenly Rooster's hand nudged my master's shoulder. 100 paces ahead stood another dam and spillway. 3 linen pavilions abutted a pleasant beach. A lantern-lit walkway snaked up the slope, past a hide corral in which were confined 12 blanket-draped war mounts of such magnificence that the worth of each alone must have equaled the produce of a small city. Directly above rose a copse of oak, lit by iron cressets howling in the gale, and beyond, past a single picket line of Egyptian marines, could be glimpsed the pennanted king-posts of a pavilion so vast it looked like it housed a battalion.
"That's it," Rooster pointed. "That's Xerxes's tent."
Chapter 31 The warrior's thoughts, at the brink of action, my master had often observed, as the student of fear he ever declared himself to be, follow a pattern unvarying and ineluctable. There appears always on interval, often brief as a heartbeat, wherein the inward eye summons the following tripartite vision, often in the self-same order. First, to the inmost heart appear the faces of those he loves who do not share his immediate peril. His wife and mother, his children, particularly if they are female, particularly if they are young. These who will remain beneath the sun and preserve within their hearts the memory of his passage, the warrior greets with fondness and compassion. To them he bequeaths his love, and to them bids farewell. Next arise before the inward eye the shades of those already across the river, they who stand awaiting upon the distant shore of death. For my master these comprised his brother, Iatrocles, his father and mother, and Arete's brother, Eidetichides. These two the warrior's heart greets in silent vision, summons their aid, and then releases. Lastly, advance the gods. Whichever a man feels have favored him most, whichever he feels himself most to have favored, into their care he releases his spirit, if he can. Only when this triple obligation has been requited does the warrior revert to the present and turn, as if arising from a dream, to those at his shoulder, they who in a moment will undergo with him the trial of death. Here, Dionyces often observed, is where the Spartans most hold advantage over all who face them in battle. Beneath what alien banner could one discover at his shoulder such men as Leonidas, Alpheus, Maron, or here in this dirt Dorion, Polynices, and my master Dionyces himself? These who will share the ferry with him,
The warrior's heart embraces with a love surpassing all others granted by the gods to humankind, save only that of a mother for her babe. To them he commits all, as they all to him. My own eyes now glanced to Dionyces, crouched upon the river bank, helmetless in his scarlet cloak, which showed dead black in the darkness. His right hand was kneading the joints of his immobile ankle, seeking to restore flexion, as he, in compact phrase, issued the instructions which would drive the men he commanded into action. At his shoulder, Alexandros had scraped a fistful of sand from the bank and was scoring it along the haft of his eight-footer, abrading the surface for a grip. Polynices, with a curse, worked his forearm into the sodden bronze and leather sleeve of his shield, seeking the point of balance and proper hold upon the grip cord. Hound and Lacedes, Ballplayer, Rooster, and Dorian likewise, completed their preparations. I glanced to Suicide. He was sorting swiftly through his darning needles, like a surgeon selecting his instrument, picking those three, one for his throwing hand, two for his free, whose heft and balance promised the truest flight. I moved in a crouch beside the Scythian, with whom I was paired in the assault. "See you in the ferry," he said, and tugged me with him toward the flank from which we would attack. Would his be the last face I would see? This Scythian, mentor and instructor to me since I was 14. He had taught me cover and interval, dress and shadow, how to staunch a puncture wound, set a broken collarbone, how to take down a horse upon the open field, drag a wounded warrior from battle using his cloak. This man, with his skill and fearlessness, could have hired himself out as a mercenary to any army in the world, to the Persians if he wished. He would have been appointed captain of 100, achieved fame and glory, women and wealth. Yet he chose to remain in the harsh academy of Lacedaemon, in service for no pay. I thought of the merchant, Elephantinos. Of all in camp, Suicide had taken most to this gay, ebullient fellow. The pair had become fast friends. On the evening before the first battle, when my master's platoon had settled, preparing the evening meal, this Elephantinos had appeared upon his rounds. He had traded away all his wares, bartered his wagon and ass, sold even his own cloak and shoes. Now, on this night, he circulated with a basket of pears and sweetmeats, distributing these treats to the warriors as they sat to their suppers. He stopped beside our fire. My master often sacrificed in the evenings. Nothing much, just a crust of barley loaf and a libation, not praying aloud, just offering within his heart a few silent words to the gods. He would never reveal the contents of his prayer, but I could read it upon his lips and overhear the odd mumble. He was praying for Arete and his daughters. "It is these young boys who should practice such piety," the merchant observed, "not you grisly veterans." Dionyces greeted the Emporos warmly. "You mean grizzled, my friend." "I mean grisly. Wake up to this." He was invited to sit. Bias was still alive then. He joked with the merchant about his want of forethought. How will the old-timer get away now without his ass and wagon? Elephantinos made no reply. "Our friend will not be leaving." Dionyces spoke softly, his gaze upon the earth. Alexandros and Ariston arrived with a hare they had traded for with some boys from Alpinoi village. The old man smiled at the comradely ragging they endured from their mates over this prize. It was a winter hare, so scrawny it wouldn't flavor a stew for two men, let alone 16. The merchant regarded my master. "To see you veterans with gray in your beards, it is only right that you should stand here at the gates, but these boys—" His gesture indicated Alexandros and Ariston, including in its sweep myself and several other squires barely out of their teens. "How may I leave when these babes remain?" "I envy you, comrades," the merchant continued when the emotion had cleared from his throat. "I have searched all my life for that which you have possessed from birth, a noble city to belong to."
His smithy, scarred hand indicated the fires springing to life across the camp and the warriors, old and young, now settling beside them.
"This will be my city. I will be her magistrate and her physician, her orphan's father and her fool."
He handed out his pears and moved on. One could hear the laughter he brought to the next fire, and the one after that. The Allies had been on station at the gates for 4 nights, then. They had observed the scale of the Persian host on land and sea, and knew well the odds insuperable that faced them. Yet it was not until that moment, I felt, at least for my master's platoon, that the reality of the peril to Hellas and the imminence of the defenders' own extinction truly struck home. A profound soberness settled with the vanishing sun. For long moments, no one spoke. Alexandros was skinning the hare. I was grinding barley meal in a handmill. Medon prepared the ground oven. Black Leon was chopping onions. Bias reclined against the stump of an oak felled for firewood, with Leon Donkey Dick upon his left. To the startlement of all, Suicide began to speak. "There is a goddess in my country called Na'an," the Scythian broke the silence. "My mother was a priestess of this cult, if such a grand title may be applied to an illiterate countrywoman who lived all her life out of the back of a wagon. My mind is recalled to this by our friend the merchant, and the two-wheeled cart he calls his home." This was as much speech at one time as I or any other had heard Suicide give voice to. All expected him to halt right there. To their astonishment, the Scythian continued. "His priestess mother taught him," Suicide said, "that nothing beneath the sun is real. The earth and everything upon it is but a forestander, the material embodiment of a finer and more profound reality which exists immediately behind it, invisible to mortal sense. Everything we call real is sustained by this subtler fundament which underlies it, indestructible, unglimpsed beyond the curtain. My mother's religion teaches that those things alone are real which cannot be perceived by the senses. The soul, mother love, courage, these are closer to God, she taught, because they alone are the same on both sides of death, in front of the curtain and behind. When I first came to Lacedaemon and beheld the phalanx," Suicide went on, "I thought it the most ludicrous form of warfare I had ever seen. In my country, we fight on horseback. This, to me, was the only way, grand and glorious, a spectacle that stirs the soul. The phalanx looked like a joke to me. But I admired the men, their virtue, which was so clearly superior to that of every other nation I had observed and studied. It was a puzzle to me." I glanced to Dionyces across the fire to see if he had previously heard these thoughts articulated by Suicide, perhaps in the years before I had entered his service, when the Scythian alone stood as his squire. Upon my master's face was written rapt attention. Clearly this bounty from Suicide's lips was as novel to him as to the others. "Do you remember, Dionyces, when we fought the Thebans at Erythrae, when they broke and ran? This was the first rout I had witnessed. I was appalled by it. Can there exist a baser, more degrading sight beneath the sun than a phalanx breaking apart in fear? It makes one ashamed to be mortal, to behold such ignobility even in an enemy. It violates the higher laws of God." Suicide's face, which had been a grimace of disdain, now brightened into a cheerier mode. "Ah, but the opposite, a line that holds, what can be more grand, more noble?
One night I dreamt I marched within the phalanx. We were advancing across a plain to meet the foe. Terror froze my heart. My fellow warriors strode all around me, in front, behind, to all sides. They were all me, myself old, myself young. I became even more terrified, as if I were coming apart into pieces. Then all began to sing, all the me's, all the myself's. As their voices rose in sweet concord, all fear fled my heart. I woke with a still breast and knew this was a dream straight from God. I understood then that it was the glue that made the phalanx great, the unseen glue that bound it together. I realized that all the drill and discipline you Spartans love to pound into each other's skulls were really not to inculcate skill or art, but only to produce this glue. Medon laughed. And what glue have you dissolved, Suicide, that finally allows your jaws to flap with such an unscythian immoderation? Suicide grinned across the fire. Medon was the one, it was said, who had originally given the Scythian his nickname when he, guilty of a murder in his country, had fled to Sparta, where he asked again and again for death. When I first came to Lacedaemon and they called me Suicide, I hated it. But in time I came to see its wisdom, unintentional as it was. For what can be more noble than to slay oneself, not literally, not with a blade in the guts, but to extinguish the selfish self within? That part which looks only to its own preservation, to save its own skin. That, I saw, was the victory you Spartans had gained over yourselves. That was the glue. It was what you had learned, and it made me stay to learn it too. When a warrior fights not for himself but for his brothers, when his most passionately sought goal is neither glory nor his own life's preservation, but to spend his substance for them, his comrades, not to abandon them, not to prove unworthy of them, then his heart truly has achieved contempt for death. And with that he transcends himself, and his actions touch the sublime. This is why the true warrior cannot speak of battle save to his brothers who have been there with him. This truth is too holy, too sacred for words. I myself would not presume to give it speech, save here now, with you. Black Leon had been listening attentively. What you say is true, Suicide, if you will forgive me for calling you that, but not everything unseen is noble. Base emotions are invisible as well, fear and greed and lust. What do you say about them? Yes, Suicide acknowledged. But don't they feel base? They stink to heaven, they make one sick within the heart. The noble, invisible things feel different. They are like music in which the higher notes are the finer. This was another thing that puzzled me when I arrived in Lacedaemon, your music. How much of it there was, not alone the martial odes or war songs you sing as you advance upon the foe, but in the dances and the choruses, the festivals and the sacrifices. Why do these consummate warriors honor music so when they forbid all theater and art? I believe they sense that the virtues are like music. They vibrate at a higher, nobler pitch. He turned to Alexandros. That is why Leonidas chose you for the 300, my young master, though he knew you had never before stood among the trumpets. He believes you will sing here at the gates in that sublime register, not with this, he indicated the throat, but with this. And his hand touched his heart. Suicide drew up, suddenly awkward and abashed. Around the fire each face regarded him soberly and with respect. Dionyces broke the silence with a laugh. You're a philosopher, Suicide. The Scythian grinned back. Yes, he nodded. Wake up to this. A messenger appeared,
Summoning Dianeces to Leonidas's council, my master motioned me to accompany him. Something had changed within him. I could sense it as we picked our way among the network of trails that crisscrossed the camps of the allies. "Do you remember the night, Zio, when we sat with Ariston and Alexandros and spoke of fear and its opposite?"
I said I did.
"I have the answer to my question. Our friends, the merchant and the Scythian, have given it to me." His glance took in the fires of the camp, the nations of the allies clustered in their units, and their officers whom we could see, like us, approaching from all quarters the king's fire, ready to respond to his needs.